Jensen, good morning. Oh, what do they do here? There we go. Okay, so. All right, so everything I'm going to say today, and I'm sure you're all going to thoroughly read and memorize the forward-looking statement here, is as of the last quarter earnings call, which was just last week. Okay, let me give you a quick overview. We're very pleased at Broadridge right now. We've been working a long time on what we think is a clear and executable strategy. It is paying dividends, and literally and figuratively for that matter. And so what we announced at the end of last year, particularly when both segments were going top and bottom line, and we believed we were positioned for that to go forward, because of the efforts we made strategically and from a product point of view beyond that, we now are positioned where we can, as we go forward, grow top, bottom line, and between the strong cash flow we have and the disciplined capital stewardship we have, we believe we're positioned to create top quartile stockholder returns as we go forward. Let's talk a little bit. We have two strong segments. We're the leading provider in investor communications in the financial markets, and we're the leading provider of processing solutions. Now, we do these activities from both segments for banks, broker-dealers, mutual funds, and corporate issuers. We only focus on financial services. We do that because it's the absolute top of the pyramid in terms of requirements, whether that be data security, whether that be accuracy, whether that be functionality. It's very difficult to be commoditized when you're providing mission-critical services in financial services. I'm not saying there's not competition. I'm not saying there's not price pressure. What I'm saying is that it has to be right, it has to be secure, and it's very difficult to start something up with low functionality and win any market share of any meaningful nature because of the requirements of this industry. Compliance activities for our clients is a very, very difficult activity. Being in compliance is an absolute must. So again, being focused only on financial services with a strong differentiated product makes it very, very sticky. Those three groups we talk about, I'm sorry, the four groups that we talk about servicing, again, banks, broker-dealers, mutual funds, corporate issuers, those groups, right, absolutely are the product set that we're lining up against. So at times people say to me, you know, Rich, I heard you went from 80 products to 150 products. It's really in two activities. It's communications and it's processing, all right? And we are well positioned because of what we do with them to present more products to their ever-changing needs. Strategically, we've really made significant progress in fine-tuning what we already believe was a clear and executable strategy through two segments and to a select group of financial service entities. And I'm going to cover now the three themes that you should be viewing us as driving forward to create even more opportunity beyond the solid base we have, the 99% client retention rate we have, the strong sales we've had, last year record $121 million, related to our products, and in particularly a lot of activity in the emerging and acquired products that we've been adding over the years. So let's talk about the strategic themes. There are three key themes that are driving activity for us right now. First is digital. We live in a digital world. Because of regulations, because of compliance, it's very difficult to just say to customers, you need to take this digitally, or it must be digitally. The customers must agree, and the value proposition must be that it's a better alternative than paper. We've proven our ability to create the value proposition by eliminating, in one of our largest products and our largest segment, proxy, we've eliminated over 60% of the paper and postage right now today. Our industry, financial services, still spends $20 billion a year in paper and postage. Now, by financial services, I mean broker-dealers, mutual funds, and annuity processes or annuity providers. We're focusing on the next $2 to $3 billion of opportunity, which is statements, confirms, prospectuses, new account openings, etc. The things that we're already doing today in paper for our clients, and applying that same proven, create a differentiated, better value proposition digitally, just like we did in proxy for these other activities. We have a couple of ways we're doing that. One way was our investor mailbox product, where we create an icon on our client's website where they can click on there and we can provide them all the digital activity. There are 16 firms live. There are 8 firms in the process of going live. But most importantly, a long multi-year effort of about 4 years has just been successfully concluded with the New York Stock Exchange and the SEC, whereby what we call our investor mailbox product, the SEC encouraged, now has regulations that provide economics to broker-dealers and encourages broker-dealers to create an investor mailbox, or what they call EBIP, which is Enhanced Broker Internet Platform, all right, which we believe is going to drive the adoption rate of the investor mailbox product up. And that's a product that we have that's live today that we can implement today. Beyond that, we've looked at how people live their lives versus how our industry is asking people to live their lives, and for that matter, most every other industry. People live their lives by going to a couple of sites. In my case, within 5 minutes of being up on Apple Newsstand, getting the Wall Street Journal, all right? My wife is now using Amazon extensively, all right, and not buying as much from bulk providers because she can go online and it's at the front doorstep in a day or two, in more convenience without having to carry it home. So you want to get to me, a great place to get to me is through Apple Newsstand. That's where I'm living my life every day. Between Facebook and Amazon, my wife's on one of those sites at least every day, and probably in the case of Facebook, more than once a day. That's how you get to her. So, but we're saying to the world, you know what? We want to make your life more convenient, and all you need to do to live your life is remember 50 to 100 passwords for everybody who wants you to help them lower their cost, all right? It's not going to work. So we've built Fluent, okay, which is a overriding digital strategy in Broadridge. So we're trying to create a brand around the term Fluent. But more importantly, what we've done is we've created the ability to go directly to channels where you would get a notice that you have content waiting for you. By clicking on that, you'll seamlessly move to the broker's, mutual funds, annuities website, okay? But it will be Broadridge behind that. If you want to do more activity, you can seamlessly move into their actual website, but also seamlessly get back to where you started. So it's allowing people to live the lives the way they want to live them versus the way you'd like to make it more convenient. We also need proof with proxy that the online activity has to be better than the paper activity. Anyone in this room can use their iPhone. If you haven't signed up, go to investordelivery.com. But anyone in this room can use your iPhone or other device and vote a proxy in 3 clicks. Okay? That's easier than opening an envelope. It's far easier than getting the envelope out of the mailbox and opening it. So, in the case of digital content, it can't be the same static content. You can't expect someone to scroll through 50 pages online of static content and think it's going to be a meaningful experience. So these are the activities we're taking place under the Fluent umbrella right now. I want to talk about cost mutualization next. Cost mutualization is the new fancy word for outsourcing, right? There is one slight difference, which I'll get to. At Broadridge, we've been in the outsourcing business for a long time. We've been taking mission-critical functions, and we've been taking those functions and combining scale and functionality beyond what people can justify on their own and providing them a better, more reliable environment, all right, at a lower cost. That's what you can do by combining scales on non-differentiating yet very important activities. So we're already processing 5 to 6 trillion a day in settlements for financial services. That's 5 to 6 trillion, right? So what we decided years ago as part of our strategy, and at times, although it was difficult to stay with it, we stayed with it, was we said beyond the technology, we should be enabling people and provide the people beyond the technology, right? And we've had our BPO capability. That BPO capability led us into recent activities like Bloomberg Tradebook, where we just closed that transaction last year. Okay, I'm sorry, they went live last year. We closed it the year before that. And last year we also announced a strategic alliance with Accenture, where we're the technology behind an Accenture post-trade processing platform or solution. Société Générale is signed, okay? The people were just transferred very recently over to Accenture. And during calendar 14 and calendar 15, we're going to be moving the technology onto a Broadridge platform. What we find particularly exciting about this is we've always had very good coverage of markets in North America. We had relatively limited coverage for every place outside of North America, which is a lot of geography to cover. This solution in our alliance with Accenture is initially targeted at Europe, Asia, the Middle East, and Australia. We're doing processing for clients in all of those markets today, but our ability to cover those markets would really be a parachute in and fly out the next morning activity. Accenture has meaningful presence in the top financial institutions in all of these markets. So I would right now say that at Broadridge, our go-to-market capability and our ability to represent ourselves in markets is the strongest in the markets when we're with Accenture, because their business is being in those clients' offices on a very recurring basis, and their business requires them to build C-suite relationships. So very quickly after the announcement, they targeted the top 50 financial global institutions. But by the nature of the partners that cover those institutions, they've actually had dialogues with over 150 institutions and have had a very high percentage relative to this type of activity of follow-up requests. In some cases, it may be to understand what competitors are doing, but it's a C-suite activity. And at Broadridge, our C-suite activity was very good up to the director of ops and technology, the head of ops and technology, and was very limited beyond that. This gives us a far better branding and presence, all right? And I loved when Accenture and their investor day talked about how they partnered with the best provider of these capabilities out there. So we're very excited about mutualization. But again, that's a proven model for us. You should not view that as being something new. The last thing is data. And data is something that is not natural to our DNA. But we would argue that we sit on more data than anyone else in financial services. So first of all, we're doing right now, we're approaching about 50 million in revenue right now today in activities we do around data. Very early on, after we became a public company, we acquired a company called Access Data. Access Data had built these wonderful modules for mutual funds to understand distribution better, for them to be able to reconcile 12b-1 very accurately, and to be able to do 22c-2 also at a flawless level. The reason it was called Access Data was because all they needed was access to the data, and these modules could do that. At Broadridge, because of what we do, we virtually know almost every transaction in mutual funds by providing prospectuses to the marketplace and then our recurring other activities of distributing semi-annuals and annuals as required by regulation on behalf of our broker and bank clients. So Access Data proved that if we had the ability to go in there and mine the data, we could create activities and content from that that have value. We've used that model. We've done some other transactions like Bonair and Investigo. But we're now looking at the data we have And with our client's agreement, and only with our client's agreement, mine that data to their benefit, but create generic data that will also be of value to other entities. And if you think about what we know about wealth in North America, it's pretty extraordinary. So that's just giving you an idea as we're thinking from a executable strategy going forward. Now, if you take that with, our 99% recurring revenue, our ability to create product on our own, our proven ability to buy tuck-in acquisitions where we can take a product that the market wants and putting under our rock-solid brand, create a far better distribution capability for that product. If you look at our capital stewardship, where we've made dividends a priority from day one, it's now 84 cents a share per year. We've increased it every year at the end of every full year since we've been a public company. Our consistent view and intent to deliver cash back to shareholders, we believe, is proven, and we think dividends is the best consistent way to do that. We very much have confidence in our ability to execute, and we would like to do more tuck-ins than we've done in the past, but we won't do a deal for the sake of doing a deal. And when there weren't deals that met our criteria, both strategically and financially, we've bought back opportunistically because we clearly believed in our ability to create greater value going forward. Last year, we returned a little bit over $300 in cash to shareholders between dividends and share buybacks. So we believe between the business we have today, the opportunities it has today, the things we can close on today, combined with our capital stewardship policies, we're positioned to deliver consistent top quartile returns, and that's our intent. I just want to clarify one thing a couple of pages forward, and then I'm going to open it for Q&A. So what you heard me say today is that we've got Horizon One activities, and in a difficult market after the financial crisis, we stuck to our strategy, all right? And even though we had wind in the face with declining activity from same clients, our product activity and our acquired and emerging products, whether they were built or acquired by us, all right, enabled us to stay ahead of the financial crisis, albeit not create the performance overall we would have desired. We consistently have done this to the point that without markets coming back, we got both segments back to the position of having strong results, okay, top and bottom line. In our first quarter, we recently experienced, okay, not what I call a strong wind at the back, but where activities from existing clients were giving us growth beyond the activities that we planned on that we could control on our own. And the growth we had in the first quarter of about 10%, half of it was from expected activities we control, and half of it was from some market activities. So when you look at this chart and we're saying we've proven that we are good Horizon One players long before we became a public company in retaining clients and serving some of those clients well. We've proven that we can add product because we've doubled our product set, okay? But don't be confused by that because it's communications and processing. We're just adding more apps to that, so to speak, all right, in Horizon 2. And between Horizon 1 and our expansion into Horizon 2, we've positioned ourselves that even in difficult markets, we can create value. We're absolutely not changing that playbook. What we're doing, though, is we're looking at how well-positioned we are on things like digital, okay, cost mutualization, which is the hot term out there, which in some ways will be a Horizon 3 activity as we do new things like Accenture Alliance. In some ways, it's almost Horizon 1, Horizon 2, and Horizon 3 activity. But data clearly would fit into the Horizon 3. And even on digital, well, it's Horizon 3 for the $20 billion that's still out there. But it's absolutely, you know, a repeat of what now we're treating as Horizon 1 with our very successful digital activities that we proved not only could we do, not only could we take cost out, but we could make more fees from the same clients and more profits from the same clients, albeit we had a slight downtick in revenue because of the paper and postage pass-through activities. So I hope this gives you a view in Broadridge in terms of who we are, the mission-critical role we play, and why by being the proven provider of those mission-critical activities, we're so excited about our ability to execute on new opportunities as we go forward. With that, I'm going to turn it open for Q&A.
Digital in general. You talked about $20 billion in paper postage, $2 to $3 billion sort of the initial focus. What's the revenue model for Investor Mailbox? You know, what's the time horizon you think where you can capture or you know, take those costs out and obviously generate some fees alongside that?
Perfect. So let's start with Investor Mailbox or EBIP. All right. This isn't something that we're into, well, what is it or what isn't it, because it's already there. All right. The SEC just approved the New York Stock Exchange recommendation on not only EBIP, but fees for EBIP and revised fees for the activities that are in place right now. Broadridge supported these revisions. So there is the elimination fee, all right, which going forward is going to be a preference management fee. And it ranged from either 25 cents or 50 cents, depending on volume. And that's now going to be a single 32-cent fee, right? So every time we convert something from paper to postage, there's a 32% recurring fee each time. So it's not it's a one-time fee. What was recognized with EBIP is to give the brokers incentive to do what the SEC wants them to do. They wouldn't create an incentive if they didn't want brokers to do it. And, you know, Tinson, I'll let you comment on if the SEC wants JP Morgan to do something, is that an option or is that a mandate? I'll go with your view on that, not mine. All right? So, but the point here is that they provided a one-time 99-cent incentive fee for the first time you eliminate the paper by when you do that through creating a enhanced broker internet platform or our branded product is Investor Mailbox. So we believe the Investor Mailbox adoption will go up. We know what the fee is, all right, and we're in discussions with the broker on how that fee, what we're going to charge them for the 99-cent fee we entitle them to earn, all right. And we already have agreements in place that says, yes, the 32-cent fee is there, the processing fee is still there, and we charge them for both processing and for the preference exchange activity. So we know what the math is, and we know the more people we convert, the better it is, right? But there's already been eliminated 60% of the paper. So we're talking about now going after the other 40. And I would argue in that case, you know, we're getting higher into the tree to get to the fruit. The other $20 billion, you know, there are watermelons laying on the ground, okay? But it's not as easy to pick them up as you might think because there's compliance, there's data security. And in our industry, the customer has to agree. You get people to agree not by telling them you'll plant the tree in their name. You get people to agree by giving them better digital content, better digital experiences than they will get in a paper environment. And that's what I covered earlier. So we're very excited about the SEC activity. We're very excited not to be talking to you, Tinson, and others about what's happening with the exchange's proposal. We can now say it's done and behind us, all right? And we're very excited by the proven model that Broadridge is uniquely proven, and I'm not aware of anybody else proving a model in what could be considered anything near what we've done, and now taking that to the next $2 to $3 billion of opportunity.
Can you just run through a couple funny? I wasn't on the call this past week, but I saw your stock jump, so congratulations. I assume it was a good quarter. Can you just run through a couple numbers for us, if you don't mind? What's CapEx on an annual basis? What do you normally use your cash flow for? Seems like your dividend is fairly low relative to the cash that you generate. So how acquisitive are you? Just step back for a second for those of us who don't know you as well. And
okay.
What kind of margins are your goals? I mean, what kind of operating margins or gross margins? What do you tell the street? You know, what's your aspirational goals? Because I know for a while things were difficult in your industry.
Okay. A lot of questions in there. So, Tintin, you're going to be in charge of the ones I don't get to. Okay, reminding me. So first of all, let me start with the easy one, the dividend. We raise the dividend every year, and you know we're committed right now to a 40% payout. So we think that's a good payout, and we certainly expect to increase cash as we go forward. Broadridge is not a capital-intensive business, and we're very, very pleased about that. CapEx and amortization generally should be about the same, all right? David, $40 million, $35
million?
Okay. Now, we had some IBM activity that when we converted over the IBM platform, that changed that a little, all right? And so, you know, earnings and cash should be fairly close. We believe we can self-fund tuck-in activity, and we think that the transactions we've done to date have proven it's a very good return to shareholders. We believe that if we can add growth to the top and bottom line, all right, the returns that provides to Broadridge overall, all right, creates a halo over all of our shares versus the halo you get in a strong company and improving its position from just the shares you buy back, all right? So that kind of summarizes our capital stewardship, which we take very, very, very seriously. It's your cash.
How big is the buyback?
We have about 6+ million shares outstanding, all right, left in it. But the thing that we've publicly stated is that we will look to offset equity comp. Beyond that, our priorities are the dividend, always first, tuck-ins, and if tuck-ins aren't available, we'll look for opportunistic times when we can buy back our own shares. We think investing in us is a great thing, okay, both from a product point of view and otherwise. You talked about margins, and you know, let me actually go here because this chart, Horizon 1, Horizon 2, and Horizon 3, is a tale of three margins. All right? So in Horizon 1, you know, we add new business to existing platforms, and the incremental margins are very good. All right? We generally have implementation. All right? So as the client's on the platform and matures, and if we have some startup that we're going to amortize to get the client live on the platform, it really works in terms of a pretty fixed cost environment and good incremental margins. On Horizon 2, we're building scale in these products. We're making investments in these products, all right? And so the first thing to do on these products, let's use tax and stock transfer. First thing to do is to have a clear strategy to get them to break even. Then to have incremental margins take you beyond that, all right? But we're looking at everything as being the same type of business that at scale, incremental activity will generate very, very meaningful margins. The Horizon 3 activity right now is where we're using our shareholders' cash to invest in the business, all right? We will continue to do that because we don't believe anybody has a divine right to be in business. We believe that technology will continue to change markets, and we would rather be a disruptor, even if that means disrupting ourselves, rather than let someone disrupt us. So we had an improvement in margins. every year, every business unit leader is held accountable who has activities in Horizon 1, Horizon 2, and Horizon 3 to create a plan that will raise margins, okay? Market activity can hurt that, okay, and we saw that in the crisis. But our planned activities are to do all these things we're talking about in a top-line growth, a bottom-line growth, and a margin improvement activity. If we didn't have such a long-term view, we could certainly generate more significant short-term activity. We're in this for the long term, and long beyond my tenure. So that's our strategic focus, and that ties to our financial performance as well.
If I can, one more. Thank you. I appreciate it. One more question just on the capital structure. I realize you want to be a very solid credit and generate a lot of cash and pay it back to shareholders, but what I'm finding is with the market at highs and your stock at highs, the companies that seem to be good values to me are ones that could take advantage of the low interest rates and the environment that the Fed's offering companies to put in permanent capital, whether it's issuing fixed bonds 30, 20 years out, and use that to do things, whether it's to grow Horizon 2 for you or to buy back stock to reward shareholders or raise the dividend. Your balance sheet seems wildly under-leveraged
okay. For
that environment. Can you talk about that and the thought of the board about maybe putting in a little more permanent capital, given your cash flow and recurrence, and using that to enhance the returns?
All right, so think about what we do, think about who we do it for, and think about who has oversight of us. So what I'm about to describe is called sustainable differentiation, although it may appear to you to be an under-levered balance sheet. If you're going to outsource something, you have to get approval from FINRA, the Fed, and others. All right? Outsourcing to someone who doesn't appear to be in every way, shape, or form, proven in what they do, and rock-solid financial stability is not likely to be well-received. Our clients and the C-suite dialogues I have about these activities, all right, still proves to me that being investment grade is the right thing to do. Now, in terms of taking advantage of these low interest rates, we just recently refinanced, all right, our term loan with fixed rate. Okay, so J.P. Morgan was the lead bank, and we floated $400 million in bonds at 3.95%. Which I'm sure as we look back in time, we'll be saying, why didn't we do more? Or we wish we would have done more, but we're glad we did it when we did it, right? So now, in terms of levering up the buyback shares, all right, I'm never going to say never, okay? But we are committed to create a very significant investment value proposition for long-term shareholders. Okay, and whether they have a better price, slightly better this year than where it would be next year, but ultimately will get us to the same place, all right, we have no interest in doing. So throughout the crisis, many people who visit conferences like this said to us, you need to lever up and buy back shares. We didn't think it was the right thing to do then. We believe that our capital policies, in particular investing in ourselves, okay, through tuck-in acquisitions, not through big transactions where we think we're smarter than someone else, but we're buying a product that we believe we can take it to our level of capabilities, our level of reliability, and put in our distribution channel is going to be very well recognized and welcomed. So you shouldn't expect significant change in our capital policies. I think in the last call, I described a bunch of things, and then in the Q&A and said, okay, so if you didn't hear that, we're saying nothing different than what we've consistently said for a long period of time.
From a guidance standpoint, you came in quite ahead of street numbers. You didn't raise, which to us makes a lot of sense. I think you were like at least 10 cents above your internal plan, if I had to put a number to it. What do you see sort of in the next 2 to 3 quarters? I know the fourth quarter is big for you on proxy, but talk about discretionary spending, implementation cycles, event-driven fees, anything that you see today worth calling out?
Perfect. So first about guidance. In the Q&A section of the call, after I made three deliberate statements in the call, which is we'll have a clearer view in terms of the increased market activity, which uniquely benefits Broadridge because, you know, if there's an inflow into mutual funds, if people are going from bond funds to equity funds, we're doing prospectuses, we're doing transactions related to that. We've seen some uptick in the event-driven activity, even though because we were so burned after it whiplashed up and whiplashed down that you're not going to see us planning on activities like that and probably staying what we think is prudent, you may call conservative, in how we plan for those activities. The first quarter certainly showed an increase of event-driven from where we thought we would be or what we were planning on being, and better market activity. At the end of the second quarter, a number of things happened. We have a far better insight into what the proxy season volumes will be because stock records for record dates are already starting to get pretty close to what they're actually going to be, so we can project that. So the biggest quarter we have better insight into. As far as any other event-driven activity, we can at least see 60 days beyond where we'll be in the February call, which gets us pretty close to year-end. And we'll see if the trends that we experienced in the first quarter, and Dan even commented on trading trends in October, okay, being pretty good, which was covered in the call, we'll be in a position with a far clearer view. And so we feel good about that. You know, it's interesting because, Vincent, you and I were chatting a minute before this started about implementation cycles, et cetera, and you were saying that we really seem to be a little different than what you're hearing elsewhere. And so, first of all, our product set is fairly unique and different. Second of all, our industry has been talking about, since the financial crisis, the need to drive cost out, all right? And a lot of our products fit so squarely with that activity. So if you look at the Accenture Eurasia transaction, if you looked at some of the transactions we announced, whether it be Bloomberg Tradebook or other activities, we put clients in a position where they know what their cost is going to be, all right? They can predict their cost on a variable basis going forward, and it's a far better way to run a business, all right? And it's a far more efficient way to run a business. My sales team would not say that, gee, implementation cycles or close cycles are feeling shorter. And that is true. But the activity has never been better. So I think really what we're doing is not having a difference than other people are in terms of long dialogues and complicated dialogues, right? But what we're having is a lot more activities than we've previously had. So even if the cycle becomes a little more difficult, more activities seems to be more than offsetting that, and ideally will create a lift for us. Okay, thank you. I'll stick around a minute if anybody has any other questions.